Today at Reader's Corner, Matt Richtel, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention.
You know, people love to get their information. It's exciting to get information. Driving can seem boring, especially when you've gotten habituated to all that adrenaline. So listen to this disconnect. 98% of people saying texting and driving is dangerous. Huge numbers say this is dangerous. Big numbers do it anyway. 33,000 people a year are dying on the roads. I mean, this is nothing theoretical here. You can't be in a position where you don't have your brain available to you to react when you're dealing with high speeds and heavy objects.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. We've all heard the message by now. Texting while driving is dangerous. Yet each year, there are more than 280,000 automobile accidents in the United States where texting is a factor. And texting behind the wheel has now surpassed drunk driving as the number one cause of death for teenagers in our country. In his new book, A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention, author and journalist Matt Richtel explores why technological distractions are often irresistible for drivers, despite the known dangers to themselves, their passengers, and others on the road. By exploring the tragic yet ultimately inspiring story of one of the first widely known fatal accidents caused by texting, Mr. Richtel explains the magnetic draw and influence our gadgets have on the human mind and our society. Matt Richtel is a novelist, cartoonist, and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for the New York Times based in San Francisco. He writes about technology, its impact on society, and how it changes the way we work, play, and relate to each other. His series of articles about the risks of distracted driving and its root causes won the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. Mr. Richtel also is the author of three novels about technology's impact on individuals and society, and he writes the syndicated comic strip Rudy Park under the pen name Theron Eyre. He joins us by phone for this interview. Matt Richtel, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. It's a real pleasure and privilege to be here.
Well, Matt, congratulations on the Pulitzer Prize you won in 2010 for this issue of distracted driving. Is that really what put you in contact with Reggie Shaw, the guy who really is front and center in this book?
Yeah, exactly. I was reporting this story, the distracted driving story, for the first half of 2009, trying to understand what was going on with technology, the brain, society, legislation. And one of the neuroscientists said to me, "You got to meet this young man named Reggie Shaw." And boy, was he right.
Tell us about Reggie Shaw and what happened on that fateful morning.
Yeah. So let's go back to 2006. I think your listeners, given your proximity to Utah, given the, you know, you are siblings in so many ways and cousins geographically, culturally, and here is Reggie, and you just know this kid. He is a good young man. He's an all-American kid and a jock of the nice variety. You know, he plays basketball. His peers like him. He's kind to everybody. His teachers like him. He's got a wry wit. And his dream in life, he's got two. He wants to fall in love and meet the girl of his dreams, and he wants to go on an LDS mission. And then something goes very tragically wrong. And may I tell you just about this moment in time that changed him and would go on to change both the region and the state and arguably the world?
Please.
So it's now September 22, 2006, and he's driving Valley View Road, which you could probably see from the border of Idaho, but you couldn't see it at this point because it's 6:30 in the morning. It's dark and freezing rain. He's going 55 miles an hour, and behind him, Reggie's driving a Chevy SUV. Behind him, in an even larger car, is a farrier, a certified horseshoe maker, who's carrying a trailer toting 2 tons of horseshoes and horseshoe-making equipment. So, Bob, this is a missile at highway speeds. And coming the other direction, going, I guess it would be west on Valley View Road, if I have my directions correctly, are two men in a Saturn. They are heading to ATK systems. They are rocket scientists building the booster for the next space shuttle. And as Reggie is heading towards Logan, he's occasionally veering across the yellow divider. And the farrier, the horseshoe maker, thinks to himself, this guy's going to cause us all some trouble. And boy, is he right. Because the last time Reggie veers across the yellow divider, he clips the Saturn carrying these two rocket scientists. And they spin across the roadway where the farrier, unable to do anything, hits them at 55 miles an hour in a crash so violent that the two men are dead on impact. And 100 yards down the road, Reggie, our all-American 19-year-old, stops. He is unhurt, his Chevy virtually unscathed, and he says, I don't remember what happened. Maybe I hydroplaned. And that's the beginning of our story.
You know, the one thing that did occur to me as I was reading this part of the story is that he stopped. Back to being the all-American kid and the kid who was used to playing by the rules, there's probably a percentage of folks out there, unfortunately, of course, and against the law, who might have kept right on going.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up because when I was thinking about whether or not to write a book and what represents an interesting book, to me, science is interesting, ideas are interesting, but what really grips me as a reader and as a writer is our characters and true human drama. And few, if any, that I've ever met could represent that as well as Reggie. And you nailed why. Here's a guy who knows the difference between right and wrong. And he's actually a pretty conflicted guy. I won't give it all away, but he's got some checker marks in his past where he's had some trouble telling the truth. He wants to do the right thing, but sometimes he doesn't want to let people down around him. He's in a small town. He feels like he's in a fishbowl. So here's a kid who, on one level, does the right thing. He stops. But on another level, he says, I don't remember what happened. Maybe I hydroplaned. Well, and everybody who's been listening to this and knows anything about the story knows that's just not true.
And by the way, I'm glad you mentioned that you didn't want to give it away. I don't want to give it away either. So we're going to try to get through this interview without getting to some of the details. This, what I think is so impressive about your work here, Matt, is that it not only addresses one of the most significant issues facing us today on the roads and highways of this country, but it's a compelling narrative. It reads like a novel. You have great use of the English language, and you talked about characters in the true human drama. You bring so many of those characters to light. And while I'm on this subject, I have to ask you, what amazed me is what you were able to get these characters to talk about, the principles in this book. You were able to get them to go deep into their psyches and into their own personal histories and reveal things about themselves, from judges to lawyers to the advocates to the parents. How'd you pull that off?
Well, again, I want to thank you for asking something and seeing something that is so meaningful to me. When people ask me about this book, usually they want to know about the neuroscience or the story, but what I secretly hold in my heart is the great gratitude for the gift I've been given that these people shared their stories. I literally, Bob, could not believe it. I would get off the phone after an interview that left me misty-eyed, where someone told me a revelation about how they approach the world because of some startling thing in their childhood, and I'd go to my wife and I would say, I can't believe the gift I've been given. And I think, to answer your question about why they did this, I can give you two answers without really fully knowing. One is, I think they understood the sense of responsibility that I felt to them. I never took advantage of anyone. I don't judge in this book. This book isn't about villains. It's about the human condition in a very potentially perilous time. We're on a razor's edge of tough questions about attention, about morality, and I tried not to judge. The other reason, answer to your question, is I think people realized the more we got into the story, all the people, the prosecutors, the judge, the victim's advocate, Reggie and his family, I think they realized that we were building something here, building something that might contribute to the world in some small but meaningful way related to a really pressing issue, and they just gave of themselves.
Well, let's get to the point of Reggie appearing before the law, and we'll talk about just how the law dealt with Reggie, and then we'll skip over to the science and, again, encourage our listeners to pick this book up and read it to its conclusion, because it is an inspiring work. So here we are in Utah, and there are state laws for a lot of things. But now you have this young man standing before the law enforcement officials, and they're trying to figure out what to do with him. What's the options here?
Yeah, so just to bring the readers up to speed a little bit. So Reggie digs his heels in, and his family, very fine folks in Tremonton, but they don't want to see their, you know, they rally around Reggie, and he says he didn't do anything. But the police, after a real gumshoe investigation that's a bit like Sherlock Holmes in the digital age, find out he was indeed texting 11 times sent and received in the minutes and seconds around the crash, maybe right at the crash. But you're right, Bob, there's no legal precedent. There's not a single law nationally that for adults that says no texting and driving. There's been almost no scientific papers published that anyone would know about locally. It wasn't taught in driver's ed. And, you know, the prosecutors aren't sure what to do. Now, it turns out that there are a few people in Logan, in Cache County, that are very, very courageous victims advocates. They almost to a point of being unconventional, and you have to read their stories to understand why. But they basically say, let's go out and take a chance here. And to answer your question directly, what could they have done? Well, they could have given him basically, a ticket for, you know, wandering across the yellow divider, an accident, you know, a few bucks and walk away, all the way up to, you know, some homicide charges. And they pick one pretty far along that spectrum called negligent homicide. They're going to charge this young man in an unprecedented way with no real legal precedent to go on. And that is what they wind up doing. Reggie digs his heels in, and this legal standoff ensues.
Today we're discussing A Deadly Wandering, a tale of tragedy and redemption in the age of attention. Our guest is author Matt Richtel. So let's put this issue of texting and driving in perspective. Give us a few statistics on what we're facing here in our society today when it comes to texting and driving.
So I'm going to disappoint us all a little bit, including me. The short answer is we don't know how many accidents are actually caused by texting and driving, because the reporting is terrible, and because, like Reggie, many people just don't tell the truth, and because the police takes a lot of time to go and get the phone, the estimates are astronomical. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of accidents caused by using your phone in some capacity, and many thousands of deaths a year, distracted driving a leading cause of death among drivers. But let me give you this statistic we do know, and it is quite startling, especially as we begin to get to the neuroscience. In fact, this stat I'm about to give you came out in the last few weeks. It's even fresher than the ones I have in the book. 98% of people saying texting and driving is dangerous. 75% say they check a message, and 30-some percent say, about a quarter say, they actually send it. So listen to this disconnect, Bob. Let me put a fine point on it. Huge numbers say this is dangerous. Big numbers do it anyway. I can't even find a bigger disconnect in society between attitudes and behaviors than the one the only one I can find that's similar is smokers. They all say it's dangerous, and they all do it anyway. And you know the reason smokers do it, it's because they're addicted. What does that maybe suggest to you about the reason we're doing it behind the wheel?
Well, and you've spent considerable time in this book talking about your work with neuroscientists and the interviews you've had with them and the role that some of them actually played in this particular case. What is it about this business of texting that we find so irresistible?
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to give you the best analogy that I've been able to come up with to make this accessible. And it goes like this. Picture a cave person tending to a fire or building a fire, and the cave person gets a tap on the shoulder. Well, there's no way for the cave person not to turn around and see who's there, because after all, it could be an opportunity. It could be someone with food, or it could be someone with a spear. It could be a real threat. You got to turn around. Now, picture yourself in the car. You're focused on the road the way the cave person's focused on the fire, but the phone rings. That is a tap on the shoulder from anyone anywhere in the world, and you are highly compelled on a primitive level to check it. In fact, if I might, Bob, I want to take you inside the human brain at that exact moment. And it goes like this. When the cave person is tending to the fire, that takes the part of the brain that's at the front. It's called the prefrontal cortex. It's aptly named. It is the most evolved part of the brain and arguably the most evolved part of the human being. It dictates how we focus, how we choose to attend to the world. It involves many of our highest level functions. It's responsible for art, architecture, civilization. And when you get a tap on the shoulder as the cave person, or you get, let's say, the roar of a lion behind you, a signal gets sent to this very important front part from a much more primitive part of the brain. It's the part in the back. It's reptilian. It sends a signal that says, lion, run or die. And, of course, you can't ignore that signal. It's the deepest survival mechanism. Similarly, in the car, a signal gets sent when that phone rings from the primitive parts to the higher levels saying, hey, this could be really important, and it hijacks that part of your brain. That's not a bad thing theoretically. It's not a good thing when you're piloting a missile.
It's even worse for young people, isn't it?
Even worse for young people, and the reason is that prefrontal cortex is not yet developed. So even if you know these mechanisms that are going on, as an adult, you might be able to override that survival thing going, wait a second, I'm piloting the missile, ignore. But because the prefrontal cortex isn't as developed, you know, well into your 20s, particularly for men, then it's hard to resist that urge. And something else that's very pertinent to young people, but all of us, it's the nature of the information that's coming in. It is social information. Social information also is central to our survival. So now you've got something that could be anything. So there's a, you know, it could be a threat. It could be an opportunity. It's also social information. Your spouse, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your boss, your, you know, your teacher. Boy, you start to feel really helpless trying to ignore that thing. And that's why that's only the beginning of the neuroscience. We can get into more of it. My point being, though, more broadly, once you begin to understand these mechanisms, you understand why Reggie had trouble resisting, and you certainly understand why this gap exists between our attitudes and our behaviors.
Tell us about the studies at the University of Utah showing the link between cell phone use and distracted driving. I think that was the work of Dr. David Strayer.
Yeah, you know, this is another one of those things. We talked earlier about the characters and how incredible it was that they all participated and how rich their lives were. Another really remarkable moment in this story, nothing I scripted, was that as the prosecutors were deciding whether to press this case, they had only to look in their backyard at the University of Utah for the world's leading expert on distracted driving named David Strayer. And for years, while other people just wanted no part of this issue, he was looking into the idea that when you are driving, you cannot do something else and effectively drive. You know, like four times the crash risk when you're just on the phone, forgetting texting, up to eight times the crash risk when you're texting. And you know what? His is a conservative estimate. Other folks in Virginia have found a 23 times greater risk of crash or near crash when texting. Why? Because you are effectively blind when you are doing that act. If you can imagine putting on a blindfold and driving down the road at 55 miles an hour, you cover the length of a football field while you send a text blind.
How long is the average person distracted by a text, and what can happen in that time?
So the text, of course, depends per se, you know, depends on how long the text is. But let's say it's 5, 6, 10 seconds. But here's the really interesting thing, and it goes to Reggie very directly. Even after you pull out of the text, even after you look back at the road, it takes time to reorient. Now, a lot of times people get away with this, right? Like they kind of have a sense of where they are in traffic, or it's stop and go and they're stopped. And so they get a moment to reorient to the world up to, let's say, 6 seconds, 10 seconds where they're reorienting. But here's where the problem comes in, Bob. Sometimes you don't have any time to react. Sometimes things happen on the roads, like someone slips across the yellow divider, or you slip across the yellow divider, or a chair falls in the road from a pickup truck, or go down the list. Then you have no time to react, and then maybe someone dies. And if you think this sounds like hyperbole, don't forget 33,000 people a year are dying on the roads, and that doesn't include the paralyses, the injuries, the amount of money spent for insurance from our own communities. I mean, this is nothing theoretical here. You can't be in a position where you don't have your brain available to you to react when you're dealing with high speeds and heavy objects.
You're listening to Pulitzer Prize-winning author Matt Richtel talking about his book, A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention. How many states now ban texting while driving? I assume the laws really aren't that uniform, that it's going to vary greatly from state to state.
45 states ban texting while driving. Maybe it's 44 in D.C. or 45 in D.C., forgive me, but you get the idea. And unfortunately, it's made nary a dent in the issue. It's going to vary somewhat in the amount you pay, but where it doesn't vary is the penalties aren't as harsh as some safety advocates would hope for. They would say the way you really get people's attention is the way you got attention with drunk driving, where you threaten someone's pocketbook materially, where you threaten even that someone would go to jail or they'd lose their license. After all, if you ask people why they don't drink and drive, if they're honest, they'll tell you two things. One, I don't want to hurt somebody, but two, I don't want to humiliate myself. Now, the question is whether how far legislators are going to go on this, given that they too like their devices, given that they understand that this is something we have become so reliant on. And this is where, Bob, if I might just make a segue out of the car into the rest of the world. You know, the texting and driving, this book isn't exclusively about it, and maybe in some ways maybe not even largely about it. That is the canary in the coal mine. That's the worst thing that can happen when you are trying to multitask. That's the deadly cost. But what I think we're realizing now, and the book will show, is that all the neuroscience that we're talking about is applicable outside the car. If you're trying to do your homework, you have to reorient to it every time you get distracted. You can't focus. If you're trying to get a project done, it's no different than the cave person tending to the fire. You keep interrupting that part of your brain that needs to focus. It can affect your relationship with your spouse or partner because you're constantly on this gerbil wheel. Could I just mention the dopamine part?
Yes, please.
Some of the research that's the most cutting edge here, and I think most fascinating, says that when you are interacting with your device, you're getting a little dopamine squirt, a burst of adrenaline, if you will, and that you begin to kind of become addicted to it or habituated to it. And so you get a little bit more each time you play around with your device, then you want a little bit more, then you want a little bit more, and the next thing you know, in its absence, you feel bored. And so it gets hard to focus on the longer things. That level of focus, going back to the original, precepts we were talking about here, goes to building things, focusing on things, creating things. You really need that level of sustained focus. If you become habituated to constant interruption and adrenaline, you're not going to get it. And it could come at a really high cost, not just in the car.
So, Matt, last week I rented a car, and it had a screen right next to the steering wheel that, of course, was loaded with all these options, including the opportunity to dial a telephone number. I would assume that the distraction required to dial that telephone number on that video screen is really no different at all than texting a message. And I guess it raises the issue of we're not just talking about texting and driving here. Aren't we talking about this new technology that we all now have in the late model automobiles that are every bit as dangerous a distraction.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it's really, I mean, in some ways remarkable that given everything we know, that there are still, you know, companies, entrepreneurs still jacking up our lives with things that have potential danger. What they will say is, well, consumers want it. What they'll say is, you know, our investors want to see us put things that will draw people into the cars and get them into the showroom. You show these things to, you know, the scholars and the neuroscientists who work on this, and you can, you know, you can literally watch them pass out with frustration. And I think that's where we are, you know, collectively as consumers and as responsible corporations, as, you know, as scholars, as journalists, we have to keep trying to awaken people and ourselves. I don't want to be holier than thou. I still struggle with, you know, making sure my device is off and I'm behaving well so that I can focus on my wife and kids. But I think we have to still keep pressing this issue in the same way, Bob, that we learned about food. I know you've looked at the book and this analogy's in there. We learned that some food is better for you than others. When we had the industrialization of food, you know, it was great in many ways. Less expensive food brought to more people, that's life-saving. At the same time, junk food came out of it. Easy access to high calories, sugar, and fat, and we've begun to learn how to use our food judiciously. I think that's the answer here. Use our phones and our devices judiciously. After all, they are amazing. This is not a screed against technology. And when we do so, then the corporations will follow us. The same way that we've had, you know, so many people focus on healthier food. It will become a market unto itself. Safety, disconnection, judicious use of devices. We will drive it as consumers, as thoughtful students, as thoughtful teachers, as thoughtful journalists, as thoughtful policymakers. I think we can drive this, but we have to understand it first.
It's pretty clear to me that the car companies certainly haven't arrived at any conclusion on how they're going to deal with this. In your book, you talk about the Secretary of Transportation, Ray LaHood, getting involved in this thing. Is there any interest in Washington for some kind of national standard that would be imposed on car companies as to what can and cannot be on that dashboard?
Yeah, there is a Senator Rockefeller, I believe, from West Virginia, who has been on the stump and pounding it, asking for some voluntary responsibility. As to federal standards, that would fall to the federal agencies. And, you know, Ray LaHood, the former Secretary of Transportation, he was really on the stump about it. His predecessor is focused on, you know, not ignoring this issue, but I think his energy is a little bit elsewhere. I think it's going to take some settling in of the recognition that the current texting laws aren't yet working to compel different legislative action. I mean, I think people had hoped, and I commend them. I mean, the legislators in Utah did something fantastic in passing a really tough law, and I won't give away how all that happened and relates to Reggie, but, you know, I think they hoped that their laws would do something. And now I think people are beginning to assess it and say, what do we have to do next here?
There are apps that will block a phone's texting functionality. Is that correct?
Yeah, apps out there. And the short answer is a lot of people don't use them. And I think now that we've talked about the neuroscience, you can see why. You know, people love to get their information. It's exciting to get information. Driving can seem boring, especially when you've gotten habituated to all that adrenaline. But the other thing is, you know, people are paying for access to their device. I would imagine that many would say, wait, you want me to turn off something I'm paying to have access to? No, thank you.
Matt, you've done a real service here to all of us who are concerned about this issue, and we all should be. I think it's a lesson we all have to learn and address. Matt Richtel, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks, Bob.
The book, again, is A Deadly Wandering, A Tale of Tragedy and Redemption in the Age of Attention by Matt Richtel. Next week, former BBC China correspondent Adam Brooks talking about his new novel, Night Heron. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Mike Journey. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.